Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. Just dropping in for a little bit of midweek F1. Why? Because I have the opportunity to speak to someone brilliant. Not Matt. That's just Matt. Hello, Matt.
And also me.
Yeah, you're the second best one, maybe.
Maybe.
Overall.
Except for tech time.
Yeah, we've never ranked the Missed Apex panelists, have we? We could do it in reverse order.
Yeah, we could.
Kyle's the worst one because he hosts the MotoGP show and motorbikes are weird and they lean all the way over and don't fall down. So you can't trust Kyle Powers or Jules because they're on the MotoGP podcast. But you can catch their race review, which will be linked in the show notes below. That dropped yesterday. That crew is coming together really, really well. And then, of course, Chris Stevens and Christina Lee Mace, they're the next worst ones because they do Formula E, and that doesn't even have petrol or anything or make sounds. So go and check out their review of the Misano E-Prix by clicking on the show notes below. But the person we get to speak to, who's pretty brilliant, is the most successful Formula E team principal of all time ever, record to never be broken. It's Mark Preston joining us again. Hello, Mark.
How are you guys? Good to join you today.
Really good. I enjoyed listening back and listening back to the story of Super Aguri / Preston F1 that you did with us last year.
Yeah, that was good fun.
Yeah, and it just kept bringing back loads of those kind of forgotten memories from before I was doing content creation. So before I was super concentrating on F1 in a very media focused way. And then so when you start bringing up those eras, it just starts firing off loads of stuff. So what I finally, I found myself thinking about recently was my dark F1 years. So the years I paid attention to the least was probably from 2000 to 2005. And in that time, you were in the heart of the action as well at McLaren.
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was when Arrows finished in 2002, went over to McLaren and got involved in the what I call a technology demonstrator, the old MP4 18A, which I've actually got one of the tubs in our office and we use it as a simulator. So it brings back old memories. So if you're ever up in Oxford, you can have a drive on it.
I mean, that is what you've got a great facility in Oxford. What goes on there? Because I mean, really, you had me at McLaren simulator.
That's autonomous trucks, so they're so a bit boring because they just drive themselves. But the simulator is more fun.
Wow, autonomous trucks sounds great. I mean, I've done a total of about 3 years of truck driving in my life, so I don't know if my fallback is going to be replaced by your machines, Mark.
Yeah, you could probably do some of the safety driving stuff for the beginning, but once they're full driver out, then you'll be able to drive the sim then.
Oh, I see. So I'm redundant. So I've got no fallback. So I've got to make this content stuff work, which is why I'm inviting you on, because we're going to look forward to the Chinese Grand Prix. We're going to talk a bit of general F1 stuff. But I do want to do a little bit of Uncle Mark tells us about the olden days.
Sounds good.
Okay, so looking at your career, absolutely fascinating. So we started at Super Aguri last time, and I sort of wanted to work backwards then, because in that era, you're head of vehicle technology laboratories. That's a very fancy title.
Yes, it was. Yeah, we had the simulator in all the laboratories for testing all of the crash testing and stress testing and everything of the cars, yeah.
Yeah, and so and that time you had an emergent Kimi Raikkonen, who was, you know, I think the legacy of Kimi Raikkonen maybe got a bit ruined by partnering Fernando Alonso at Ferrari, but he was really the wonder kid at the time.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Obviously, when I joined McLaren, they were slower than the Ferrari and looking to do a really big change. And Adrian Newey wanted to do a completely different car, and that was the MP4 18A, which was probably one of the more unique experiences I've had in F1. Being able to go almost do anything you wanted, really, in terms of F1. So we pretty much tried everything, changed everything in the hope of catching Ferrari.
Well, so that's a little bit like the James Vowles approach now, where he's saying, right, there's no rules, there's no pressure to... Is that what it was? There's no pressure on actual results, just go nuts.
No, we had to try and beat Ferrari because we were slower than Ferrari by a good margin. And so Ron wanted to do a big step. And so Adrian said, well, let's do a big step. And the 18A was new in every single way. Everything, so the engine was different, the gearboxes had blown floors, it had all sorts of different wings and was super lightweight, and we went everywhere on that car. I call it a technology demonstrator because it didn't race. But what we did do is we took all of the good ideas from that car and put it back onto the 17, and that became the 17D, which is what Kimi raced in that year, and I think came second by a point or something like that. I have to look back at my history. So it kind of proved that a lot of the ideas were good because they were put back onto the old car. And that actually formed the basis of when I started Super Aguri and we had to take the old Arrows. I'd kind of proven at McLaren that you could take an old car, update it with all the good ideas and at least be credible. So that learning experience then got used at Super Aguri.
So just a question, quick one. So this is still when you had like a full test team and everything, and you could just run whatever you wanted outside of the regulations.
I think it might have been the beginning. We were probably in those days when you had about 15,000 kilometers per driver, I think it was.
So basically unlimited testing. Yeah.
Yeah, a huge amount of testing. two test cars, that kind of thing. So yeah, pretty crazy.
Oh, happy days. And of all the things that you tried out, was there something that really was your personal favorite thing that either somebody thought up and you figured out how to make work, or an idea that you had that just came good, even if it wasn't like the worth the most tents or anything like that?
I mean, we did a lot of things, tiny, small crash structures. We did super lightweight monocoque. What other things did we do? All sorts of suspension, lots of detail in the suspension. First, we went super lightweight, then we went super stiff. So we really did huge, big changes. Like if you talk about feeling on the edge of the envelope, we went on the edge of all of the sides of the envelope, basically. And so that's what made it so hard as a car, because when things started going wrong, it wasn't just one thing. It was a multitude of things.
Hard.
And that's what, So it was hard. So then the decision was made, let's take the good ideas and put them on the old car. And then obviously go forward.
That's what I do with, I'm going to compare my audio and video on YouTube to making an F1 car. But like with contrast, I never really know how to do it. And it was Uncle Steve said, just put it all the way to the maximum and then all the way to the minimum and then just keep going up and down until something seems about right. But that's me. That's not somebody making a Formula One car, Mark.
Yeah, it was. So I say it's a pretty unique experience. And I am just checking. Kimi did come second by 2 points. So it sort of proved that a lot of the good ideas worked, considering we put it on a one-year-old car and came second in the championship. So it did what it needed to do. Ron wanted us to go crazy and try everything. And obviously having Adrian Newey, Mike Coughlin, lots of other people at the time, I think Paddy Lowe, everybody, all of the kind of famous names were there. So it really was on the edge of the envelope.
So Adrian Newey, though, he'd come from Williams, hadn't he? So
yeah,
he'd not been there that long. When did he come over to McLaren? 2007, something like that. No, 97.
Yeah, probably something like that. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So someone who's considered like such an influential designer, you go the path that he followed could have influenced the whole of Formula One. So him leaving Williams, and you go, well, what if Hill had stayed at Williams? Does Newey stay at Williams? Does that change the course of history?
I mean, I sometimes think that in motor racing, there's a lot to do with the macro effects. And what I mean by macro is, at that time, Mercedes engine was, you know, just on song. Adrian was at McLaren. Kimi was there. So all of the pieces of the puzzle were all together at the right time. And obviously, you look at Red Bull at the moment, they've got Newey, Mack, a Honda that's on song, the right amount of money, you know, the package is there. And, you know, the package is pretty important before you can get into the details.
Well, Mark, you accidentally called that a Honda.
Okay.
I am assured it's a Red Bull powertrain, unless they're racing specifically in Japan and then they paint Honda everywhere all over it. But, you know, I will have people tell me till I'm blue in the face that was basically built from scratch and nothing to do with Honda.
Okay. It takes a long time to build things up. I must say, you know, if you look at some of the success of Mercedes, you think it's been continuously in Formula One for, 20-something years? And that continuity is pretty important. And so I know that the Honda guy said to me, when they've come in and out of F1, it really does make a difference. And it's difficult because you've got to get back up to speed again. Whereas even if you've just been ticking along in the background, you've got to start again. You sort of, everyone goes off and does other things, and you've got to bring everybody back, and you've got to get all started working together. And so that continuity that Mercedes has had is pretty important, I think.
Yeah, because it's quite a rough road. Towards the end of the last podcast you were on, we started talking about why Honda left. And I didn't actually link it in my mind at all to the world financial crash. And then they had such a rough time coming back into F1 in like 2014. Did they know? They didn't quite make the beginning
2015.
Of 2015. Yeah, so they weren't there on the ground floor. Come back in 2015, have a horrible time. But I guess all your staff have all found different jobs and careers and paths in that time.
Yeah, and that's what, like, we met all of the guys at Honda. They'd gone off and run the gearbox department or the new such and such department. And so bringing everyone back together, or at least even parts of that team, means that it's harder to get going. So that continuity of Mercedes is pretty impressive.
Yeah, so go on, Matt.
Well, I was going to say, but also it's a case of that was a really tricky set of regulations for power units, and they found the regulations essentially stacked against them because of the whole coin system, you know, where you could only have
tokens.
So many upgrades. Tokens, yep. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was a pretty difficult job, but they obviously got there in the end.
So can you give us some insight into the Newey world? Because I loved your kind of throwaway comment of, we decided to do something radical and go faster, so we did. And I feel like that's maybe how Adrian Newey does operate.
I mean, I try to think of a good example. When I'd come from doing a lot of crash testing at Arrows, and we spent a lot of time getting the rear impact structure really small. And I remember when he said to me, so how small do you think we can make the rear crash structure? And I said, X, Y, Z. And he said, oh, so I could redesign the beam wing and the rear floor then. And he kept wandering past my desk every half an hour. I said, have you sketched that out for me yet? Have you sketched that out for me yet? And this, once I'd done the calculations and said, this was theoretically possible at Arrows, he went off, and lo and behold, a couple of days later, the rear beam wing had been redesigned, and we're off working on the different rear crash structure because he was able to get more into the diffuser and all that kind of thing. So he's just always thinking, always dreaming up new things. And when someone says something's technically possible, we could do something more, then he goes, okay, then do it. So you got to watch out what you say. Yeah, that's possible. And then it's like, well, go on then, deliver
right, make it.
Okay.
Happen. Obviously he's considered to be, you know, one of the big geniuses of the sport. How did this rank structure sit there? So is he at the very top of the tree at that time at McLaren?
So he was, yes. And we had Neil Oatley and Mike Coughlin. Neil was engineering director, I think. And Mike was chief designer, I think that's right. and Adrian was kind of on top of everybody thinking of the ideas, and there's all other group of people who were delivering the car. So yeah, he was the one that schemed out the aero. He had two guys, I remember, that all their job was just to take the sketches and turn them into CAD, which would then be turned into CFD, which would then be turned into wing tunnel. So yeah, there was a lot of people that supported his sketches and ideas.
Well, that's what you hear, isn't it? That Adrian Newey doesn't like doing it on CAD. Is he really sitting there with a wax tablet and a stick, Roman style?
He has still got the big, you hear the stories, it's correct. He is, I think he probably still does have the big desk, you know, the, not the big desk, the drawing board. Drawing board with everything in half scale. I think that would be right, half scale on the drawing board. So, and,
that's quite
big. I do agree that most people say he really does kind of see air, I think. He really does understand it and just have such an eye for the total car. So I think the difference between, say, him and perhaps, imagine you've got an aero person who's just doing the front brake ducts, they potentially aren't looking at the total package, where he, when he sketches out the whole car, he's looking at the whole car and sketching out the entire thing, and then people will go into the detail about brake ducts and all the little flicks and things that have been here, there, and everywhere on cars and being deleted and made illegal and then come back and those kind of things. So yeah, he looks at the total picture of how the total package would work.
I didn't mean this to become like an Adrian Newey deep dive, but I'll continue if you don't mind. So there's been lots of rumours at the moment about Adrian Newey to Ferrari, and his wife apparently liked an Instagram post that was spreading that rumour. And then he was seen at the airport and he was doing some test days or something at the Ferrari facility. So in a Red Bull driver suit, apparently. So let's say he does move, you know, people do move. The big question is, how influential is it? And so you hear conflicting reports between he is still the genius behind that Red Bull car and he's something of a figurehead, but doesn't actually get, you know, involved in that actual, you know, basic designs. Where would you guess the truth lies?
I mean, going back to what I said about the macro effect and putting together a package, obviously Ferrari is putting together a package, which they did in the days when they... so if you look at Arrows, go back to the olden days, when I joined Arrows, Tom Walkinshaw had just been at Benetton as technical director, interestingly, with Schumacher, with Rory Byrne, with Pat Simmons and all those guys. And when he bought Arrows, the plan was, I think, to bring Ross Brawn, Rory Byrne, and all of those guys, because they'd all worked with Tom on the Silk Cut Jags, because they'd all been part of the that program. And so that package was quite impressive. But then Schumacher went to Ferrari, and they put together a better, let's call it, macro package. Took obviously, Ross, etc. It already had Jean Todt, obviously. And so then that package, all a group of people, went together. So I think... if Ferrari is, I'm imagining, trying to put together, the winning package, I could see that they're working on, they've got drivers, they've got engine, of course, they've got new team principal, they've got, you know, they're putting together a package. So it wouldn't be surprised if they're trying to put together the ultimate package. And Adrian would obviously be a cornerstone of an ultimate package.
But Matt, this is a little bit what you like, you were talking to me, you showed me a graphic of key engineering personnel moves between the
right.
teams. Wow, that would be a good opportunity for you to talk about that thing that you sent me.
I thought you were going to say another word or two first.
No,
so you caught me
finished.
Off guard there.
I was kind of late, I'm tired.
Yeah,
got a science show to do next.
But it's the brain drain. It's finding people who are senior enough, right, to transfer knowledge. This is actually one of the things that I have gotten sort of frustrated about when people complain about how long it takes teams to catch up. And maybe you could give me some insight into this, but it's the gardening leaf. Like if you decide you want to go and you tell your team, it's 18 months before you can have an impact.
I think that the gardening leaves have got longer, haven't they? I think when I started, it was probably 3 months. I mean, it probably went to 6 and then a year. I didn't know it had gone. I suppose for senior staff, it probably has gone quite a lot longer. I mean, there's the series, I'll get all NBA-ish on you. The big thing about motorsports and any cluster is that all the teams in the UK, the cluster is interesting. So that's why it's difficult to design an F1 car outside of the cluster, because it's the suppliers, it's the It's the ease of, I call the technical term is high labor mobility, meaning that in Silicon Valley, you know, it's easy to do a startup because it's easy to find people, because another startup might have just failed the week before, and you scoop up all those people and go and start a new startup. And because people can move fast in especially Silicon Valley, that's why it's easier to do startups. You've got a lot of expertise. So that's why gardening leave was kept getting longer, to stop that movement within the cluster. Now, Ferrari's outside the cluster, obviously, because they're in Italy. But there is a cluster there as well. You know, there's a lot of things like Dallara and all of those companies down there. But it is why it's easier to do something in the UK in the what they call the Motorsport Valley, because there's high labor mobility in the region.
So would they put Adrian Newey on gardening leave, or would he have some sort of better contract than that? Because I guess he's a bit more powerful, isn't he?
Yeah, that'd be an interesting one. I don't actually know. It's probably quite complicated, I imagine.
Yeah. So, yeah, it would be interesting to go, you know, if he goes there and has no effect, then do people start to unravel the mystery and myth? Because at the moment, it's like he's the aero messiah and just whatever he touches. Basically, the Tifosi are thinking, if we get Newey, we got this. We're all over it. It's done. It's over.
It's interesting. I mean, I don't know a lot about the new rules with the diffuser and ground effect, but it does seem that Red Bull has understood the full effect of that, how it all works together, DRS, all that kind of thing. And what is probably a benefit of Adrian, of course, is because he's won so many championships, the one thing that's always difficult inside a big team, if you say, we are going this direction, you better be right. Now, of course, when Adrian says, we're going to go in this direction, it's a lot easier for everyone to go, okay, we'll follow his overall philosophy. So it is important in that respect, in that it's such a big commitment to get this diffuser right, and all of the detailed design of the gearbox and the rear suspension and all of those elements. When someone says, we are going this direction, that dictates so much on the car. And even just in that one thing, if Adrian says, we are going in this direction with the diffuser, et cetera, et cetera, then just that one decision can be hugely impactful, because then the rest of the car is designed around that philosophy.
Lewis, eighth title, that's what I'm hearing.
It would be interesting.
Well, now I want to ask you, I refrained earlier to spare Spanner's feelings, but one of the rumors about Newey was that the thing that he really authentically designed on this generation of Red Bull was the rear suspension. And you were talking about that when you were working with him. And they did. They flipped, I believe, from a pull rod rear to a push rod rear for these regulations, probably for aerodynamics. But does he have like that global command of how the suspension works as well, like mechanically? Or is it really just his ability to fit it in around the aero that he wants to be most efficient?
The rear suspension, I'm guessing, given that the diffuser has been such a big part of this regulation set. Again, his philosophy, again, I'm not detailed enough to know about exactly how it's working, but the whole DRS and everything working together, that rear area, everything links together. So, you know, something you put on in the old days, if you put a gurney on the back of the beam wing, it would change the diffusers, the way the air pulled through the diffuser. And if you change where the suspension, rear suspension sits, I'm imagining his first pass would be, here's the diffuser, here's what I want the suspension to look like in order to benefit the diffuser and the beam wing and the DRS. Now you would go to the suspension guys and say, now tell me if we can make this work. Can we get the stiffness? Can we get the geometry? Can we get the squats and anti-squats, dives, etc. working? And then those guys would come up with, here's all the parameters, this is what we might have to tweak. And then he'd do another iteration, perhaps on the geometry, to make sure that he could make the diffuser work the way he wanted to. So it's an iterative process, but I would say he probably came up with the original concept, and then everybody works to figure out how to make it happen.
So then he just walks past their desks every 30 minutes till they produce it.
I do love this image of Adrian Newey kind of going, it's the equivalent of, are we there yet? but yeah. for a design engineer. Did you fix the suspension yet?
Yeah. Yeah, does it work? Is all the parameters right? Come on, guys, what are you doing?
So you guys were in a similar situation, I guess, to where Mercedes and Ferrari are at the moment, where they're just, you know, you guys were staring at the Michael Schumacher Ferrari dominance, and, you know, the rest of the world is looking on, because this period of dominance is probably on the same level as the Schumacher Ferrari one. You know, in that, do you remember Schumacher was like, would win by laps, and he'd win by, it's only because of the Pirelli tyres now. Verstappen could win by a lap, and he could lap the field if he wanted to. It just doesn't make sense. So kind of, you could put yourself in the mindset now of Ferrari and Mercedes. When you guys were in that position, could you look ahead and go, we kind of know what they're doing, we just need to get there? Or was it, you know, a mystery?
A couple of things, I would say. What they also had was the tyre war. So Ferrari was so wonderfully, let's say, intertwined with Bridgestone that when we had Super Aguri, we also had Bridgestone tyres, because Bridgestone was a partner of Aguri in previous seasons. So we got to work very, very closely with Bridgestone. And so I know the tyres, and working tightly with the tyre manufacturer can have a huge impact.
Well, okay. There'll be a lot of young fans like me, Mark, who don't really know what that relationship was. Is it okay to like explore, you know, what was the relationship between Ferrari and Bridgestone allegedly, and why does it give you such a big advantage?
Because basically they trusted, you know, they trusted Schumacher to be right about his feeling on the direction of developing the tyres. And it's another one of these macro knock-on effects where he gives good feedback, they change the tyres, he goes faster, they win. And you get into this, like, to this, you know, not a spiral, but a close working relationship where you'd say, why would you talk to anybody else about the tyres, almost? Because you say, we just keep going on a good thing. The Bridgestone's job was to beat Michelin. So if I was the, you know, the Bridgestone guys, I'd be like, whatever Schumacher says,
yeah, you can
keep
do
going
it.
That direction.
So is it that Schumacher was able to give feedback that was specifically suited him, or that he was just generally helping them make a better tyre?
Generally making a better tyre, but what happens is that the interaction of the tyre and the gain, going back to philosophy again, the philosophy of the Ferrari at that time with Rory Byrne and Ross Brawn and all those guys, the philosophy of the car matches the tyre matches the car, and it starts to, you know, walk down a path where the two things are completely intertwined. And if you then put those tyres on another car, with a different weight distribution, a different aero setup, a different engine.
Driver, yeah.
It just then won't work the same as the Bridgestones on the Ferrari. That was definitely an advantage.
Oh, man. See, F1 keeps falling into these traps, don't they? So when you get that, you've got an insurmountable advantage. When you had the double diffuser, you know, Red Bull were locked into that. And then the Mercedes engine was such a massive advantage. In fact, it's harder to point to an era where that wasn't the case. I think it's more often that one team has this strange technological locked-in advantage for years than not.
Yeah, if you look right back to the really olden days when Honda was obviously with the turbos and all those kind of things, they were, you know, wherever the Honda went, you could pretty much say they might win a championship because they really had the cut of the engines at that time.
So it's hard to say to, you know, modern. I'm a big, obviously, defender and apologist for F1 when there's domination. So I always say to people, yes, it's part of F1. It's not always going to be this and that. You have to wait for the regulations to converge. But periods like the Schumacher-Ferrari one are hard to defend. And the one at the moment is really hard to defend.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the past, things changed, didn't they? Whenever there was a dominant period, they changed the tyre rules or something changed to see if you could. I think when we had groove tyres and the narrow track widths and
glory days,
things like that. Yeah, some of those things that changed in the hope that it would mix up the grid. Probably more things was when Schumacher retired and then various people left the team, and that it sort of then starts the next cycle. So again, I go back to my thing about the macro effect. These big, you know, these bigger periods of stability for the winning team is pretty key.
So I'm just curious about this. Is this the case because Formula One itself has become so well engineered across the board that you can't have these, oh, hey, what if we put a wing on this kind of sudden performance gains? Literally, it's been explored so much. that everything is a marginal gain of a certain kind.
If you go back to the diffuser on the Braun car, that they once they'd figured out what worked, the whole rear suspension, as we came to before, and the gearbox and everything is intertwined, and therefore the entire rear end is designed around this loophole they found. And then anybody else who wanted to copy that diffuser then would be sitting there saying, we can't redesign the gearbox in time. We can't redesign all the rear suspension, so that diffuser won't work. So we're going to have to design the whole rear end of the car in order to get the double diffuser to work. But if it gets banned at the end of the year, what are we going to do? So it's so functionally integrated. It's probably the right word term. That it's in the old days, you could just put a different engine in or a different, a gearbox, and it wasn't so intertwined with all of the suspension and aerodynamics. But now it's so integrated, you can't change one thing without changing everything else.
Do you think that the FIA, because your memory of that time will be better than mine, do you think that there was more of an effort to shake the regulations up when it was that Ferrari domination than now? Because now I'm struggling to think of anything, they've done in 22, 23, 24, or looking forward to next year. There's not even like an attempt to shake things up. And that's always been what F1 has done.
I'd say anecdotally, it sounds right.
I'm not quite sure
if I'm correct, but it does sound right from what you say.
I'd go with the redefined technical directive 39 that kind of nerfed Aston by mistake, but
collateral damage.
I think the problem here is that they have just done a better job than everybody, and there's not a target. There's not a DOS or a Frick or something like that that they can say, oh, let's take that off your car and see how you do then.
My understanding of this diffuser and DRS that obviously Red Bull's come up with is such a interesting philosophy that it's very hard to follow. I.e., it's hard to design your car to experiment with whatever they've come up with at Red Bull. It's not an easy, we'll just change the diffuser or we'll just change the rear wing. It's actually fully integrated with the whole package. And so it's a big, big step that they have to do to catch them, I think.
Well, look, I said, I'm putting you in the shoes of the F1 regulator and saying, what would you do? And you're both going, nothing, it's impossible. So instead, I'll put you in the hands of a Toto Wolff and James Allison, because it's been a bit of a disaster from testing where they were so happy, even hitting the ground in Bahrain. They seemed giddy, and then it's sort of gone wrong again. And to be honest, Mercedes have probably let F1 down in that they were the team that was supposed to be challenging Red Bull. And there's obviously, my read on it is that there's potential there. There's something there. They just can't find it. And do you have any insight into what's going wrong?
I mean, somebody mentioned a silver bullet on someone's podcast, I think, over the last few weeks. When anybody mentions the word silver bullet, I always get a bit worried, because that means that, we've just done one thing wrong. And as soon as we fix that one thing, we screw up that bolt tight, and that bolt tighter, all of a sudden everything works. I've never found that to be true.
Right. It's never been that.
It never works. And anytime anybody starts looking for the silver bullet, you start thinking, oh dear, that means either don't understand it or something's not working right, and it won't be one fix. It'll be a combination of, redesign the whole rear end of the car, maybe, I don't know, to be able to take advantage of whatever the total package's benefit that Red Bull's got.
But they are talking like that. And I remember in 2013 when they couldn't get the rears to last more than a few laps, and they were going, I had a dream where my wife came in and went, oh, it's so obvious. It's just a ride height issue. And then I relayed that to Mercedes and they managed to solve it. But so there's never a thing where you're really struggling with a car and someone goes, hang on a minute, and turns the plans upside down and goes, here we go. It was this all along.
Yeah, I haven't experienced that. I must say, when you look back at that MP4 18A, when it was a pretty big decision for McLaren to say, we're going the wrong direction, take all the good ideas off that and put it into that car. It was a pretty big ballsy move, really, to do that. And it did actually pan out, because then that car came second. So it has been done before, but it's a big decision to make, obviously, to change complete direction. Take a risk on a one-year-old car. That was back in those days, to do something. So it wasn't just a silver bullet. It was, take all of those ideas and put all of those ideas onto that car, and that wasn't just a small job either.
Well, yeah, and I'd assume it's even riskier when you don't have 30,000 kilometers of testing.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, so you can't validate all your tools and simulations. So you got to get them right first, and then to be sure that what you're doing is correct. And then, you know, that iteration, it's a different job to be done now than it was in the past.
How much can you use the fact that you've got two cars? So can you really like make changes on one? Because like, it seems like George Russell is like the control Mercedes at the moment, and Hamilton's the experiment.
I think the problem is if the aero package or whatever, you know, they're going to have to change is big, it won't just be a gurney flap or a different rear wing beam element or a different top wing element. It's going to be complete diffuser, rear suspension, gearboxes, everything that intertwines to do the whole rear end, if that's what they're looking at. And that's a big job, and you can't just, we'll do it back to back on a different rear wing versus a such and such, and a bit of camber difference and a bit of tire pressure difference. That's not what they're looking for. I don't think they're looking for something bigger. They're looking for, I don't know what actually they're looking for, but and not just a silver bullet either. I think they're looking for probably a philosophy change to their strategy,
which isn't going to be quick, is it? So yeah, that's not how I imagine it. That's not the romance I imagine, Matt, where I would go, we'll just run one slightly differently and then move towards the concept that goes faster.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask about the simulation and the tools and the validation a little bit in this era where everything is so restricted. Because, you know, you do hear it from time to time. Oh, you know, the correlation's wrong. And then the team seems lost. How long does it take for a team, when there are simulation tools and their mathematical fudges for the wind tunnel are off, how long should it take for them to be able to sort that out? Because this sounded like an area that you were actively working in at McLaren.
Yeah. The hard thing is that if we knew the answers, it would be easy if you start from that. And therefore, usually the very edge of simulation is inherently an error you don't understand, because if you did, you'd get it right. So when you're modeling tires and things like that, in the linear range of the tires, it's easy. That's fine. It's when you get into the nonlinear area where there's temperature effects and effects of the track, roughness and all those kind of things, you truly are working in an area that you don't understand, because that's the definition of it being hard, is that you don't know all of the pieces of the puzzle. So when you're working in areas where it's difficult, you can get it wrong because you don't know the answers. And that's potentially the issue, that when you're in the unknown, it is the unknown for a reason. And so then you've got to get your models to work. You've got to correlate them step by step. So I imagine perhaps at the races, go back to your question about what you would test, that's where you might be running maybe different parameters in order to test your model. So if you just do one guess, you know, you need to do two or three to get a, a map of where you're, where you think you are. So maybe you're on one car, you put such and such setup, or on the other car, you put a different setup, and then you'd validate against your, you correlate your models, and then you say, wait a minute, something's not correlating still, and then you try another point, and you're trying to figure out which parameters you don't understand. And then once you think you know that, you then do more experiments. So yeah, they may be using the races as a correlation exercise.
So just extended testing. But it's a shame we don't see that as fans, isn't it? Because that's almost like the real battle. I think the closest we've come to a good film depiction of it is that brief scene with Rush, where Niki Lauda goes in and he's like, oh, your bolts are all too heavy. Now I've done this. Why didn't you all think of this, you idiots? I'm so clever. but yeah, I think, you know, if we saw even a fictionalization of that race side of over a race weekend from Friday to Saturday to Sunday, that's really fascinating, isn't it? It's that, you know, especially recently with Mercedes having great FP2s and then, oh, we're so happy with this. And then FP3, they go, yeah, we changed something again and we don't know what happened. I think, am I wrong? I think that little period would make quite a good film or entertainment.
I mean, when we were at Super Aguri in the first year, we were just trying to chase the pack. We were just trying to get as close as we could to the back of the pack. And so every Friday was, that driver, we had a third car as well. So third car in the first session, you're doing that testing. Takuma, you're doing that testing. Anthony Davidson, you're doing that testing. And we would run as many validation tests as we could when the track
spanners
was green.
You used the spanners method. See? It does work.
When the track's green on a Friday morning, it's not always great for doing certain testing. So you might go out and do an aero validation or something like that when the track's a bit green. And then once the track rubbers in, that's more likely indicative of qualifying or the race. Then you start running different long runs and those kind of things. So yeah, we used to do a lot of testing at the races. You don't really want to be doing that because you should be just landing and just going racing. I think when we run championships in Formula E, usually the weekends that we were successful are the ones where, I'm not saying there's no questions, you get there, you run, everything's smooth, you win the race. it's way easier than, oh, we better test all this stuff because we're not sure what we need to be doing. And then you waste time it's a spiral both ways. The more you win, the more confident you are, the less you have to play around.
I'm glad you touched on Formula E. We're running short on our time with you, Mark, but we're hoping, this is what I keep doing, I make sure that I'm respectful of your time so that you'll come back and speak to us. So obviously, you know, coming from Arrows, McLaren, Super Aguri, then out to Formula E, I've been desperate to speak to you about Damon Hill's move to Arrows, but I'm going to resist because I want to talk about Formula E and Formula One converging, because inevitably, over time, we're going through a little flirtation with sustainable fuels, which is pointless because I don't think you'll ever run the road network on sustainable fuels. So if you want to be road relevant, you've got to be electric. What does Formula E do as F1 eventually moves towards electric?
I've just been looking at the 2026 rules, actually, because I hadn't realized that how electrified it actually was.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I'm sure you'll do a tech talk thing at some point.
You're embarrassing me because not only was there a tech time, they did talk about this and I edited it by none of it's gone in. So if you want to reiterate it, that's fine.
Yeah, I understand that, you know, the ICE engine may have to run quite hard under braking in order to regenerate batteries and everything. And so it's going to be quite an interesting powertrain development. And the interesting thing is that the 350 kilowatt motor, so lo and behold, Formula E is 350 kilowatts, so and super high efficiency. So I could, if you go back, in the olden days again,
that's
Formula
good.
One in 2007 started KERS. Williams McLaren obviously did a lot of work on batteries and electric motors, etc. And that really did form the basis of Formula E at the beginning, because the McLaren battery went into Formula E and the motor was out of the P1, out of the McLaren, and that had come from F1. And so I think it wouldn't surprise me if some ideas come back from Formula E, because we've been running super efficient electric motors, and F1 has only been needing to focus on just more revs, more power. To answer your question, I don't think they'll converge. I think with the 50% electrification that Formula One's doing, the only thing I could see maybe next is the front wheel drive doing regen. And so they will be highly electrified, but still keep the internal combustion engine as the energy source, I suppose you could say.
The designer at Mercedes, Andy Cowell, I believe, blue skied an idea for a car that was basically like a 3 or 6 tenths of a liter, 3-cylinder with a 350-ish battery. And is that where you see them going in the end? Equal electrification, and as the regen gets better, as their ability to harvest the energy becomes more efficient, just gradually shrinking the size of the internal combustion engine, and essentially, yeah. I mean, till where it really is almost mostly a generator and less of a power supply.
Yeah, in the end, you could see it becoming a range extender, basically. And I can see that being the case. I don't know if that'll be great for TV and the fans and the noise and everything. We'll have to wait and see what that sounds like, because I don't know what it'll sound like. It'll be an interesting thing to behold.
Yes, yeah, so it's almost better if they don't converge, because I would feel for Formula E, who seem to be getting close to what the battery tech can deliver, and it is now maybe marking time, waiting for battery tech itself to improve.
Yeah, I think there's one more step in the Generation 4, in the next generation, which we're going to be doing with Lola and Yamaha. So going back to Damon Hill, Yamaha again, then we're going to have some amount of front-wheel drive in this generation, the next generation. But Generation 4, which is the one following, 2 years' time, that'll be an interesting next step. And then I imagine, you know, solid-state batteries to come and a few things like that. So I don't quite know where it's going to go, but it's going to be interesting.
The issues were highlighted by the Misano E-Prix that we just watched. And so we've got our Formula E podcast crew. They do a great job. I got into it. I made sure I watched the whole weekend, and I jumped on and I saw the Peloton style racing, because they were so exposed with the power capabilities where they couldn't really race properly until 3 laps from the end. And you go, okay, I get the tactical saving side, but that's not it for me. It's not there.
Yeah, that's a combination of obviously the drag levels and stuff not quite working out at that track. I'm not sure what will be the solution to that in the future, but certainly everybody's working on what could we do to make sure that the Peloton doesn't work the same way. It was quite exciting in those final 3 laps. But
yeah, it's not quite enough of a payoff for me to watch 25 laps and then 3 laps of racing at the end. 25 laps of saving.
In Monaco next week, it'll be great fun.
Yeah, okay, so I'll make sure I tune into Monaco sort of for a redemption. But it was the first one my daughter sat down in front of, and she was like, I kind of enjoyed that. And then on the Sunday race, I said, it's another Formula E race. Do you want to watch it again? And she no, I'm okay. But it is hard with these motorsports, because it's hard to capture fans' imaginations at every single race. Because if you made every race, you know, spectacular, then none of them would be, really, and you'd lose sporting integrity.
I think it's the same as football, isn't it? There's lots of 0-0 draws that are fairly drawn out and boring. So I think, you know, everyone talks about that wonderful match that was Man United versus such and such in whatever year it was, and think every single match is like that. But you have to watch an awful lot of 0-0 draws to get to that super exciting nail biter.
It can't be 4-3 against Bayern Munich in the European Champions League final every time. I bet that's exactly the one you're referring to in 1998.
Something like that.
Yeah, so you don't actually see a convergence between the two sports staying separate. And when you say front-wheel drive, that confused me. You don't mean actually powering the wheels at the front, because wouldn't that affect the handling quite drastically?
Yep, and that's why there's a lot of software. That's a lot of software work in Formula E, because you have to balance the two powertrains. So at the moment, the front powertrain, it doesn't actually have rear hydraulic brakes, because you don't theoretically need them, and therefore it's only got front hydraulic brakes. And the balance between the two powertrains, front and rear, is part of the secret to all of the software development in Formula E.
So are you saying now we are powering the front wheels in Formula E, or is that the plan for the next generation?
Next generation. So at the moment, it's just full regen from the front the front wheels, and effectively the brake bias, because when you regen from both front and rear, you're biasing the brakes between the two.
Such as they are. And will that come with, I'm going to use the words, torque and vectoring for each individual wheel, or is it going to be just a driven axle?
It's we still have a mechanical differential, so therefore you can't torque vector.
All right.
Oh man, I feel like I need to beg you to put you in the hands of our baby Formula E panel so they can grill you about this kind of thing, Mark. So with that Formula One tech going forward, I think the concern is that even more of what's going on is going kind of behind the veil, is going away from what the viewer can see. And it's, you know, are we gonna see this thing of cars having to like lift and brake halfway down a straight?
I mean, F1 cars still do lift and coast, as they call it. So you probably, if you listen to the radios, I'm guessing they say lift and coast. You know, you need to save fuel, lift and coast on the next laps. And I think George Russell had to do it, didn't he, at the last race? There was somebody I did hear them saying on the radio. And the best way to save energy, because energy is proportional to the speed cubed, and therefore...
That's what I always say, yeah.
And therefore, top speed really eats power. So therefore, if you really want to save fuel or energy, you lift and coast at the high speeds and you can save quite a lot of energy.
Yeah, and so, but a lot of that too is going to be down to the aerodynamics that go along with this generation of car. We're still a bit far out to be, I guess, to be doomsaying and saying it's going to be, oh yeah, you know, like I think somebody said, oh, you know, don't be surprised if you hear the engine running full out through lows because we've got to regen. It's going to sound weird. And it seems like to me, maybe someone's trying to put their finger on the scale a little bit of these regulations to help themselves out.
Yeah, I haven't actually started thinking about it enough until I started recently. I probably listened to your tech talk, actually. Maybe that's what it was that I started making me think
time.
About it.
You're the download that they get.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, maybe start thinking about it because we're obviously looking at the Formula E stuff and thinking, okay, I wonder what the difference is between us and F1 and what are they going to have to do and when are they going to have to lift and coast and all those things. So I don't know what the final solution will be, but... I can imagine there will be some of those aspects of having to run the motor flat out in certain places.
Oh, man, we never even got to Arrows. Next time, can we start at Arrows? You've had a really fascinating career, Mark, and I really appreciate your feedback and your experience. And I do want to call the segment on Under the Tree, Learning About the Olden Days with Uncle Mark. You can find Mark on Twitter at MarkPreston3. Oh my God! So you missed out. You missed out on Mark Preston, Mark Preston 1 and 2, and you're stuck with Mark Preston 3. It's memorable though. Go and follow Mark there. Go and follow Matt at MattPT55. Come and follow me, Span at Spanners Ready. I'm the best one. Oh, and I've just accidentally switched to a picture of me sitting in a living room with plants and foliage. So sorry to the YouTube people. Bear in mind that you can still book to come and see us in Miami. MissedApexPodcast.com/Miami. For all the details of that on the Saturday of the Grand Prix. So after the sprint race, we'll do a sprint race review. But wherever we see you next, which will be Sunday morning, we are deciding whether to make Matt wake up at what will be 6 a.m. his time, having not slept at all, to join us on the podcast. But I think about 11:30 a.m. UK time, we're going to do our Chinese Grand Prix race review. Until then, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.